Okay, so let us continue on right effort. And so the idea, again, of right effort is to kind of overcome some of the coarser hindrances of the mind, especially ill will. We talked about that already. And I want to talk a little bit about just about sensual pleasures or sensual objects. So this word in Pali that we use when we talk about sensual pleasures is karma. Karma, not the same thing as kamma. Kamma means action. Karma means like sensual pleasures, but it means two things really, and it means the sensual objects of the world, all the things that we hold on to, all the things we own, all the things that we kind of experience in the sensual world, and it also refers to the desire that kind of desires those things in the sensual world. So it's two separate aspects to this world, karma. And when you understand both of those aspects and these suttas, they come out quite nicely, and you see how they kind of how they work together. So the idea behind this is just to have some ways to think about sensuality, to kind of reflect on it, to have a perspective on it that is realistic, and that actually helps you to move forward in your practice. These are not so much things to be implemented directly. They're more like kind of long-term strategies, if you like, or ways to think about this that gradually head you in the right direction. So, and this particular sutta is one of, again, I really like this sutta because it has, the similes are very powerful and very useful, I think. And very often, one of the nice things about the suttas is that they have a mixture of kind of theoretical aspects of the Dhamma, which where the Buddha explains how things really are, and they have a lot of metaphors and similes that kind of draw out the meaning in very beautiful ways. And this is one of the sutta which has a number of similes to explain about sensual pleasures. And I read it out almost pretty much every retreat I do, because I think it's very useful to reflect on this. Again, ill will is much more important to overcome, but also useful to think about the sensual things of the world as well, a little bit at least. So this is how it goes. This is just an extract. It's in the middle of the long sutta, and it's the Buddha speaking to a layman called Potalya. And this layperson, Potalya, he thinks that he has given up all sensuality. He's become a real ascetic. And then the Buddha points out that he has a little bit more to do. And this is part of that process. This is what the Buddha says. Householder, suppose a dog, overcome by hunger and weakness, was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing on such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. And eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the sensual pleasures have been compared to bones. Yeah, bones smeared with blood. That's what sensual pleasures are like, according to the Buddha in this little simile. And the idea behind this, and I will draw out the meaning a little bit, even though it is probably reasonably clear. It's good to draw out the meaning a little bit in these similes. And of course, the idea here is this dog that is hungry. That's what it starts off with saying, that it's hungry and weak. And if you're hungry and weak, you're looking for something to satisfy you, something to still the hunger so you can feel satisfied and you can be contented afterwards. So poor dog, it runs around to the butcher shop. That's probably, dogs in India are quite different from dogs in the Western world. And dogs in India are kind of not owned by anyone. They're running around semi-wild. In the West, the dogs are really pampered by comparison. In India, it's a very different story. Actually, it's different. Very interesting how in different countries, dogs are treated very differently around the world. But anyway, so it's a very, when you think about a dog here, you have to think about the dog in the Indian way, not the way kind of dogs you have as pets in Australia. It's a very different idea here. So these dogs running around trying to find something to eat, looking really mangy, looking kind of semi-sick, yeah, always kind of desperate to find something, really thin and scrawny, these dogs. And then he comes to the butcher shop, finally finds a nice butcher, and then he waits outside the butcher shop, waiting for something to be thrown. But the butcher is not going to throw a wild, semi-wild dog anything nice. He's going to make sure he gets all his meat, he can sell it to his customers. And the dog, all he gets is this bone smeared with blood. And if you are hungry and weak, yeah, and you get a bone smeared with blood, you get kind of the taste of the meat, a little bit of taste, yeah? But then as soon as you have licked off that blood, you are almost as hungry as when you started out, just as weak. Nothing has really changed. And so you run off, still craving, still desiring strongly, desperate to have a good meal, and you move on to the next butcher shop. The next butcher is exactly the same, because this is the nature of butchers, that they don't want to throw out good meat to a dog. So they goes there, exactly the same thing happens. There's no stilling of the craving. There's maybe a tiny temporary stilling as it's licking the blood. Yeah, a little bit of stilling of craving at that point. And then runs on again. And so the dog keeps on going from butcher to butcher, from house to house, from place to place, never really satisfying its hunger. And then in the middle of all that running, what happens? In the middle of all that running, the dog dies. And the dog is kind of, and because it is running already, it gets then reborn as a dog in the next life, and kind of hits the ground running and keeps on running again as a puppy, and more running, keeps on going like that from life to life, and there's no end to it. It doesn't understand that it has to look for that satisfaction somewhere else. This is not the right place to look for satisfaction. And of course, we are the same. We are pretty, you know, the same kind of idea here. You run around for one thing after another one, and every time you run after something, it promises you satisfaction, it promises you contentment, it promises you a sense of finality and completion, that you've actually reached something which is really worthwhile, a true goal, something which actually is final in a certain way. But of course it isn't. There's a short time perhaps when you feel a little bit satisfied, and sometimes you feel, you know, you get it and you feel kind of slightly depressed sometimes. You have this, you find the goal of your sensual pleasures, and you feel a bit depressed because suddenly you realize that actually the craving itself was part of the meaning of running after things. The very running was what gave meaning to your life. The craving said that if you get it, you will be happy, but actually suddenly you realize actually the running itself was kind of the meaningful thing here. But it was also very unsatisfactory. Yeah, so you get there, and then you feel kind of slightly empty, and then the craving re-arises, because you actually identify with the craving itself sometimes. Why do we identify with the craving? Because we identify with the doer. And if you identify with the doer, you want to actually do. And because you want to do, you crave, so you identify with the craving. So this force inside of you, this drive inside of you, which ensures that there's always a distance between you and where you want to be, you actually identify with that. You're identifying directly with suffering itself. This is what is going on here. So you keep on running, identifying with suffering, never finding that happiness, always taking the bait that down the line somewhere is going to come, because you don't really analyze the situation properly. And then one day the Buddha comes and says, but listen, you know, look at this. You're not kind of looking at this carefully enough. There's another way of looking at this. Yeah, you're not actually getting anywhere. This craving is always lying to you, never telling you the truth. Yeah, and then the Buddha says there is an alternative. And I think this is the reason why we never really consider that this is suffering, because it's all we have very often. Most people, that's the happiness they have in their life. They don't realize that there is an alternative. The Buddha says there is other type of happiness. It's called spiritual happiness, niramisa sukha in the Pali. And that happiness, it starts off with the happiness that you get from being kind, from being generous, all these kind of other happinesses. And these are happiness that are felt in the present moment. They have no craving related to them. And because they have no craving related to them, they actually give a real sense of satisfaction, a real sense of completion. It's a very different type of happiness, the happiness you get from kindness, from spiritual qualities, compared to the happiness of sensual pleasures. It's a very different feeling to it. And the amazing thing, and this is kind of what Buddha points out, is that if you keep on developing that spiritual happiness, to enhance it, to make it more powerful, to bring it into your meditation practice, and then practicing the samadhi or whatever it is, there comes a point when you get so much happiness in that meditation. There comes a point when your mind is so still, all craving is gone. And when all craving is gone and you're completely happy, satisfied, bliss out, you feel that you have reached the real goal to which craving was pointing towards all along, but which craving could never actually deliver. Now you have found it, but you had to take a completely different path. The path of a spiritual practice rather than the path of endlessly pursuing the sensual objects of the world or the fame or the glory or these kind of things which are part of the sensual realm really. Suddenly you have got there. You have arrived at this thing. This is why I'm saying this is really about the meaning of life, because you were always trying to get there. You couldn't find the way. You didn't know how to get there. Now you have got there. You have found that answer that you were looking for all along. You're completely satisfied. You become immobile. There's nothing more to be done. Why? Because you have reached what you were looking for. You're happy just sitting there. And this is why deep samadhi, when you get there, you just sit there for hours and hours. Yeah, some of you can, you know, when you sit for long periods of time because you feel so happy and contented and peaceful, it is the kind of first taste of that absolute contentment. It's the beginning of that. And you start to feel how wonderful it actually is not to always be driven around by craving. It says in one of the suttas, the Ratapala Sutta, you are a slave to craving. It feels like you are the master, you choose to crave. Actually, it's the other way around. Craving is driving you. Craving is whipping you over the back, making you run and run and run, never finding that peace, never finding that satisfaction. So this is the simile of the dog and the bone smeared with blood. And a very powerful simile. Try to reflect on that, because try to bring these similes into your life. What does it mean in your life? Can you relate to this? Don't we all sometimes do this kind of things, running after things, just running from one thing to another one, never really finding satisfaction, from one relationship to another, from one house to another, from one thing to another one, one entertainment to another one, just going on and on and on. I'm sure most of you should be able to relate to that fairly easily, at least to some extent. Of course, fully relating it is quite hard, because you can only fully relate to these things when you see the alternative being the mind, which is completely contented and satisfied and all that. So there you are. So that is the downside of sensuality, of sensual objects, and the upside, if you like, of the spiritual path, which is quite different. So that is the number one of these similes. Okay, number two, householder. Suppose a vulture or a heron or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away. And then vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, again, I'll draw out the meaning a little bit of the simile, even though this simile also is, if you think about it, it's not that hard to see what the meaning is. And here the meaning is that we are always fighting over the sensual pleasures of the world. We are always kind of in competition over these things. You finally, this little bird finds a nice piece of meat, yay, and it flies away, so happy. And all these other birds, you know, birds are pretty harsh. I don't know if you have seen birds in nature. You see it all the time when you live in the forest like we do. They're pretty ruthless and harsh with each other. And if you find a piece of meat, you can be almost guaranteed other birds are going to come after you and try to rip it off you. Yeah, and of course, if you are flying high up in the air and other birds pursue you in that way, well, you're going to achieve, as it says here, death or deadly suffering as a consequence. Deadly suffering is actually not, I don't think, the ideal translation. It means like suffering, which is kind of equivalent to dying. That's really what it means. Deadly suffering is a little bit of a weird expression. So suffering, which is roughly equivalent to dying, is really what it refers to. So we fight over things. We're always competing over things. Yeah, we're competing at work to kind of to show who is the best who can get the promotion next time so we can increase our salary. And sometimes when people tell me about the things that go on at work, then I'm very happy that I've chosen a good line, a good profession for myself, where that sort of competition doesn't really occur. Yeah, and it's really, really nice. Because most people seem to think that work life sometimes is so, you know, so much backstabbing, so many things going on. Because people try to get ahead, yeah? People are trying to, and the kind of modern ideas of capitalist economy, we're all supposed to compete. Cooperation is not supposed to be any good anymore. Or everything is just competition. And I think that's really crazy, yeah? I mean, we should be more cooperative than always competing with things, I reckon. Yeah? Anyway, so much nicer to cooperate than to always compete. Yeah? So we compete, and of course, because we compete, all of these bad things happen, and you suffer as a consequence. Or we compete over partners in life. That's an obvious one, yeah? Very obvious. Many people have kind of similar desires in terms of partners, so we fight over that. That is often very traumatic. Crimes of passion being one of the major causes of crime in the world. People kill each other because people are unfaithful and they leave them and all these kind of things. Yeah, so very, crimes of passion, very, it's a very serious problem. Or we fight over small things. We fight over inheritance. That's also another big problem in the world. The more money you have, the more you fight. It's madness. The more you have, the more you fight. It should be the other way around, surely. But actually it isn't. And then, of course, in the daily life, often you see children fighting over little things. We always big wars going on in the world, wars over resources, because we want to kind of control our economic growth and these kind of things. Ultimately, that too is caused by sensual pleasures. Yeah, so much violence, so much problems, so much because of the sensual pleasures in the world. And the Buddha actually makes this point very clearly in the Mahanidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 15. He has this nice kind of setup where he shows, starting from craving, yeah, and then craving makes you pursue all of these things. And because we pursue them, then we end up guarding the things that we get. And because we guard them, and we cling to them, and we hold to them, and then when somebody else wants to take it, we fight over it, and we take up weapons, and we kill each other, and all these kind of things, based on sensual pleasures. And this is such a interesting idea, because what it means, what the Buddha is saying, is that it is inherent in the sensual world that there is violence, that there is competition, that there is problem. You cannot live in the sensual world, you cannot live and enjoy sensual pleasures without violence, without competition, without clashing. Yeah, it is part and parcel of the same thing. And once you kind of start to get that, every time you're attached to things, every time things are yours, you're setting up a problem, you're setting up a situation where you're going to compete over things. Once you kind of get that, it turns you off these sensual pleasures. You realize this is terrible stuff. Oh, it leads to so many more problems, because, of course, violence and ill will is a far deeper problem than just sensual pleasures in their own right. But because these always come together, and you can't really separate them, there's a very serious problem there. But there is another type of happiness. We were just talking about it before, the spiritual happiness. When you have a spiritual happiness, it's an inward. You don't compete over that inward happiness that you have for yourself. There's no competition at all. In fact, it is perfectly free of conflict and violence, perfectly free of all these things. And in fact, it enhances cooperation. It enhances our ability to be kind. Yeah, it's a completely different attitude to the world. So that happiness, it actually leads to harmony, it leads to happiness, it leads to a society which is far better, whereas the sensual happiness is inherently conflictful kind of happiness. So this is the problem. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the hippie generation, where hippies were going to enjoy themselves, but they were also going to have peace. Yeah, they were going to kind of be peaceful, but enjoy themselves in the sensual life at the same time. But really, it's impossible. It can't be done. If you have one, you're always going to have conflict as part of that. So let's enjoy instead the spiritual happiness, because it leads away from disharmony, it leads away from conflict, and it leads towards a better world at the same time. So that is the second problem, the second simile here for sensual pleasures, sensual objects, and sensual desires. Third one is householders. Suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the blessed by the Blessed One. Now, they provide much suffering and much despair. Well, the danger in them is great. So the idea of a grass torch, obviously it provides some kind of satisfaction, because when you light it, you can see where you're going. So it gives you some sort of happiness, if you like, because you can actually see what you're doing. But because it is a grass torch, grass, the embers come off very quickly, the grass burns down, and then if you go against the wind, the embers will blow back on you straight away, and suddenly your robes are ablaze, if you use a grass torch, if you are a monk or a nun, or your clothes are ablaze or whatever. So it is inherently problematic, and sensual pleasures are very similar, in the sense that as soon as you pick up a sensual pleasure, as soon as you attach to it, as soon as you make it your own, then as soon as you do that, you're asking for suffering. Yeah, you're asking for suffering, because we know that all of these things are impermanent. You can't really control them. They're going to go according to the nature. Our relationships will break up. Our partners will die. Our house will get robbed. At the very least, when you die, you're going to have to give all of these things up. One, nature is going to claim back its own. They are not really yours to control. So as soon as you attach to something, as soon as you say something is mine, you are saying, please, may I suffer. That's what you're saying at that point. So are you saying that in your life? Please, may I suffer. It's a nice way of thinking about it, because it kind of draws out the implication of attaching to things and holding on to things, picking things up and grasping them. And this is one of the reasons why the Buddhist path is part, a very important part of that is relinquishing things, not grasping onto things, not holding on, because gradually we are reducing the potential for suffering in our life. The lighter you grasp things, the less suffering there will be when things eventually have to go. It's a gradual movement away from attachment. You can't detach straight away, but what you can do is gradually reduce the attachment, stage by stage, until one day perhaps you are detached completely. This is kind of the goal, the end goal of this path. And the way that impermanence works in the suttas, things are so inherently unreliable. You never know when things are going to get difficult. You never know when things will change. It is almost as if you are, standing on a carpet, and somebody comes and can pull out that carpet from under your feet at any time. And that is impermanent. Suddenly nature comes and pulls out the carpet. And when you, because standing is like attaching, you think that you have a firm foothold somewhere. Yeah, I can hold on to this. And as soon as you hold on to it, nature comes, pulls it out. That is impermanence coming. And because nature pulls it out, you stumble, you fall over, and you hurt yourself as a consequence. That is a consequence of taking a stand in the world, holding on to things, attaching to things, etc. So you just never know what's going to happen around the corner. So these similes are pretty stark in some ways. But again, remember, there is an alternative here. That's kind of the point. Okay, next one. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or suffering, or death-like suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this is really kind of, laying it on the line. It's like a charcoal pit, sensual pleasures. So I don't know if you have ever, of course, if you have been to my retreat before, you have considered this before. But if you have never been on this retreat before, you never read the sutta before, what is the likelihood that you will consider sensual pleasures like a charcoal pit? They're pretty close to zero, yeah? I'm not sure how many people in the world have ever thought of that. I got my new BMW. It's a charcoal pit. Yeah, it doesn't work like that. Yeah, we don't think like that. So I drove in a BMW not so long ago. Somebody drove me back home from the city. I never met this person before. And I thought, wow, what is this? This car is really kind of amazing. It's very hard to see that as a charcoal pit. And I admit it's very hard. So how is this possible? It is so removed from our ordinary ways of looking at the world. Yeah, it's really kind of so far removed. What is going on here? And to understand what is going on here, you have to look at another sutta, which I also often quote at this particular point. That's the Magandhya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 75. And there the Buddha actually explains this simile in greater detail. And what he says is that, he says, suppose that there is a leper. Yeah, if you have leprosy, it's a very kind of very bad infection of your hands. You have all these sores everywhere. Sometimes your digits even fall off. Yeah, and it is incredibly itchy. So to be able to deal with all that leprosy and all the itchiness, you actually enjoy burning yourself over a fire. They call it cauterizing yourself over a fire. So you get to this fire. This is a fire just like this, a charcoal pit. Yeah, there's no flame and smoke, meaning it's really, really hot. So you go to this charcoal pit and you literally don't hold your hands over it to stop the itching. So even though it actually is obviously very painful, it is far preferable than the itching itself. Yeah, isn't that interesting? You enjoy that burning sense because the itching is so powerful. And then the Buddha says to this Magandhya, well, this man who is a leper, after a while, his family and friends, they find a doctor for him. They cure him of that leprosy. And once he's cured and he's happy and free, he asks Magandhya, well, would that man go back to that same charcoal pit and burn himself now? And Magandhya says, of course not, because he's free of leprosy. And then he says, well, you know, before... This man's perceptions were so distorted that he thought that what is actually painful, what is painful actually is pleasant. Yeah, so distorted is your perception of reality. What is painful feels as if it is pleasant. So what is it about that leper which is distorted? Well, the main distortion is this incredible craving to get rid of the itch. Incredibly powerful craving, because the itch is so powerful. So what you are doing when you put your hands over that fire, you're getting rid, you are actually satisfying that craving. And that is the pleasure that you're feeling, yeah? The pleasure of the craving disappearing, basically. And even though it is burning you, the satisfaction of getting rid of the craving is far greater than the actual pain from the burning. And that is why, you know, how this actually works. And the Buddha is saying sensual pleasures are exactly the same. It's the same kind of problem. Yeah, our outlook is so distorted that it feels like these sensual pleasures are happy when actually they are suffering instead. It's a complete reversal of reality. Why is that the case? And the main reason is because the craving can often be so strong that just to get rid of the craving, actually, that is the very pleasure. Even though the thing itself may not be very pleasurable at all, it's the getting rid of the craving that is the pleasure in this. So it's kind of crazy. We crave so that we can get rid of craving, yeah? You crave, you think, yeah, I crave a lot. And then when I get rid of the craving, I will be happy. And you crave some more so that you can get rid of the craving in the future. That's really what's going on. It's like I was saying yesterday about smoking. Smoking is actually terrible. Yeah, you smoke a cigarette and you cough and splutter and you think it's weird and it's absolutely awful. And then you get addicted to it. And then the taste is still exactly the same, but boy, does that cigarette taste nicer. Yeah? Why? Simply because of the craving. The craving is so powerful. You are releasing that craving, and that is why it feels nice. But there's nothing inherently nice about smoking tobacco. Okay, maybe there's a tiny bit of pleasure there. People who are tobacco aficionados, I'm sure they can find something nice in that tobacco smell. But, you know, basically, it is the disappearance of craving that is the point there. And one of the interesting things, this was actually Ajahn Brahm who told me this quite recently. He told they had put people having sex, yeah, they put them in an MRI scanner and to see what's happening in the brain as they're having sex. And what they found, and this was kind of the astonishing thing, they found that the areas of the brain that become active when you're having sex is the pain center in the brain. Yeah, you actually are experiencing pain. And when you read this afterwards, the Buddha says that it is like a charcoal pit, yeah? Actually, it suddenly makes sense. It fits together. The main reason why these sensual pleasures are happy is because the craving becomes so powerful that when the craving is released, that is the majority part of the happiness in that situation. Yeah, very fascinating. Because sometimes you get these clicks where you have some kind of modern scientific research and it just fits in bang with what the sutta says. And this is one of those circumstances where it kind of fits in really, really nicely. Yeah. So sometimes I always thought, this sounds just too much. But probably, as usual, as always, almost the Buddha has got it spot on. It really has got it right. So remember that. And when you remember that, the whole thing starts to become a little bit off-putting. It's a bit just like smoking cigarette for the sake of then being able to get rid of the craving afterwards. It's nuts when you think about it. There's this eternal running around. And then as you do that, very often the craving increases as well. It gets worse, yeah? And then somehow, because the craving gets worse, then the pleasure when you release that kind of gets even greater. And it goes on like this, and there's no end to it. Always running after something. Something that never can give you, obviously, this sort of thing can never give you any satisfaction. It is so obvious. So, very worthwhile to reflect on that. Okay. Let's go on to the next little simile here. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Yeah, and again, I think a simile which is quite intuitive. You can understand why sensual pleasures are like a dream, because so much of the sensual pleasures are like looking towards it, looking forward to it, looking kind of hope, you know, getting there, thinking about it. And then when you actually get it, very often it doesn't really measure up to what you actually were expecting. It's like a dream of perfection, dream of completion, dream of satisfaction, but it never gives that thing which you are, which you think it will give you. Yeah, when you are young, and I always like to kind of think about myself when I was young, because it's very so obvious in my case. I was always thinking about, yeah, I'm going to do this when I go old. I'm going to have this kind of job, this kind of girlfriend. Yeah, I'm going to have this kind of house. I'm going to be very successful. Yeah, when you're young, you have this conceit that you're going to be very successful in some kind of odd way. And then, of course, your life carries on, yeah, and it moves on, and then kind of you realize it's not going to work out quite that way, and things kind of change, yeah? And in my case, it is so obvious that I have failed, yeah, in my dreams, yeah? I ended up in this. I'd never dreamt in my teens that I would ever become a monk, yeah? So that's why I thought about all these other things. So it was a massive change in my case. But for everyone, there is that. Your dreams and the reality, there's always going to be a large gap between the two. And this is kind of the problem. And as you move towards the goal of that dream, you change your dream because you realize it's being unrealistic. Yeah, okay, I'm not going to be quite as successful. I'm not going to have this particular partner in my life. And things change. And then always changing, always kind of dropping down, reducing the expectations as you move along, because you realize you've been kind of over the top. The dream is never the reality. And every time you crave for something, look at that, because it is like a dream. It is like this idea of something which is going to give you satisfaction, which never actually does that in the right way. So there's a large-scale dream of life in general, and there is a short-scale dream, which is every time we crave for something. All of this is part of this dream, and it's actually unreal. And to drive home this point a little bit, let's go to the next sutta for a while before we come back to this sutta. This is one of my favorite little suttas. This is called the Samiddhi Sutta. And I'll just read it out and comment on it in a second. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the Hot Springs Park. Then the Venerable Samiddhi, having risen at first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs, he came out and come out, he stood in one robe drying his limbs. Then, when the night had advanced and a certain devata of stunning beauty, a certain like god, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samiddhi. Having approached, he stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samiddhi in verse. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, monk. You don't seek alms after you have enjoyed. First enjoy, monk, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. So here you have two opposite ideas of how one should live one's life. Then the devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samiddhi, you have gone forth while young, monk, a lad with black hair endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life without having dallied with sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, monk. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. That is kind of, that's temptation for you. That's kind of this stunning devata telling you, enjoy yourself with sensual pleasures. You can imagine. Anyway, so this, I think the point here, this is very likely to be like a simile for how we think about the world. I don't know if this actually happened quite like this. I think it's more like the mental proliferation is here, that devata, the way you think about things. It's a simile for your inner processes. That's what I take it to be here. And then he replies, I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and the danger in them is still greater. While this Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. So this here, you have these two opposing things, And I've just been talking about very similar kind of opposition all the way through now. Two opposing things. On the one hand, the sensual pleasures. They are available, said the devotee. They are right in front of your eyes. Come and enjoy yourself. You are pursuing this path. Who knows when Nibbana is way down there. Maybe you can't get it in this life. Not only is it time consuming, maybe you never get there. Why are you wasting your time? Now you can enjoy yourself. Makes sense, Makes sense. Wait a minute. Have we made a mistake? It makes sense. Maybe it's true. And I remember this was very funny, because a few years ago I went to Indonesia. I was in a place called Balikpapan. You know where Balikpapan is? It's on Borneo. Balikpapan means under the plank or something like that. It's a name. It's a very, very endearing little town on Borneo. Anyway, I was there and I was giving a talk. It's what you do when you go to India. They take you around to all the cities and they give talks everywhere. And it's actually quite nice in many ways. While I was there, there was a young man sitting on the very front bench. I read this out. I said, who is right? And he said, of course the devata is right, he said. So, so this is the problem, yeah? This is the issue here. So, but the interesting point here is, of course, that the Devadatta actually is wrong. Yeah? This is the interesting point. And this is kind of how, when you perceive things in the right way, when you perceive things according to Dhamma, it actually turns things around. And suddenly you get a very different idea of reality. Yeah? And why is that? And this is exactly what we've been talking about now, about sensual pleasures being like a dream, like being something which is always in the future. Yeah? Craving, because sensual pleasures are always to do with craving, it means you're never quite there. It is always kind of slightly out of touch, out of reach. You know, you can't get there. There's always a distance between you and your goal. Then you reach it for a short while, and it isn't really satisfactory. And because it isn't satisfactory, craving returns very quickly again, and you continue searching. Our life is this eternal pursuit, always going after something. Yes, it changes when you get older, you are a bit more chilled, but this craving is still there, underlying things in a certain way. You are never there, always moving on to something, never actually achieving it. It is always concerned with time. It is never actually in the present moment. So it's actually the exact other way around. Yeah, sensual pleasures is what is concerned with time. And that is the problem. But the Dhamma, what is it about the Dhamma? If you think about the Dhamma in terms of your practice in the present moment, yeah, if you practice right now in the right way, if you think in the right way in this moment, if you do an act of kindness in this very moment, an act of generosity, if you get a bit of stillness in your meditation in this moment, you gain the happiness straight away. And that happiness is a present moment happiness that has got nothing to do with craving. In this way, the Dhamma is immediately visible. Yeah? Don't think about Nibbana, think about the effects of the Dhamma right now when you practice according to it. That is how the Dhamma is right here in the present moment. So this is the right way of thinking about the Dhamma. This is the right way of thinking about sensual pleasures. Yeah? It's actually counterintuitive. It's the opposite of what we think it is like. So, and this is why this little line at the bottom there, this is the standard way that the Dhamma is qualified in the suttas. Yeah? It is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see her. Applicable, upanayaka, means like you are kind of practicing and moving onwards, moving forward, something like that, to be personally experienced by the wise. All of these things deal with the fact that you can experience it now to some extent. Yeah, it is a real, real thing. Yeah? It also means that the result is directly visible in this life, but every little result is visible right here and now. So that is this little conundrum. Yeah, the Dhamma should always be some fun conundrums in the Dhamma. That makes the Dhamma more interesting. Yeah. So there you are. And by the way, what is also a little bit fascinating about this sutta, it starts off at the beginning and it takes place in Rajagaha, in the hot springs part. Yeah, have you been to the hot springs park? Yes? Right. Yeah, that's exactly where it is, yeah? And this is one of those beautiful things about going to India, is that it's almost like you walk back into the suttas. Hot springs park, 2,500 years ago, you go to exactly the same place today because you know where it is, because the mountains there is very... You know, Rajagaha is described in the suttas. There's all these mountains around it. It's very obvious that when you get to Rajagaha, and then you go to the base of this mountain, and lo and behold, there's a hot springs bath there. Yeah, nothing has changed. 2,500 years later on, exactly the same thing. The people may have changed, but the bath is still there. I don't think the same people, they don't look that old. But there is, you know, but certainly the bath, okay, it's a bit more fancy now. It's kind of made, you know, you have tiles and that kind of stuff. In those days, probably just was a few rocks around. But yeah, it's like stepping back in time. So you can go there and you can kind of imagine yourself being Samiddhi, yeah, standing there and kind of thinking about the big questions of life, yeah, and then kind of coming to a conclusion. It's really neat. It's really kind of nice when you, this is one of the wonderful things about going to India. There are some bad things about going to India as well, but I prefer to kind of think about the good ones. So. Okay, the bad ones are that it's very polluted and very kind of easy to get sick there. That's the kind of the negative side. But anyway, it's worthwhile going at least once in a lifetime if you are really a committed Buddhist, I would say. Let's come back to the similes again. householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, fine jeweled earrings, and proceeded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, this is also a very nice simile, and this is very similar to things I have been talking about already. I like to repeat myself a bit. And here you have this person who has borrowed luxury items, a nice carriage, fine jeweled earrings. Doesn't, by modern standards, doesn't sound too kind of astonishing. But still, in those days, probably this was kind of, you had to have the really high class to have a proper carriage, yeah, with drawn by horses or whatever, that kind of stuff. And of course, once you do that, and people look at you and they say, "Wow, look at this person! They got a carriage like this." It's like today, if you have a really fancy car, you'd like other people to see it. Yeah, you drive around the streets, being very cool in your kind of nice car. Yeah, and people say, "Wow, check out this car! It's really nice." And it's always been like that. It's always a bit like this. We identify with our property. We identify with the things around us. Yeah, we create an identity out of that. And of course, once these things are taken from you, in this case, by the people who have lent you these things, come and take them back, you feel like naked. Everybody thought you were wealthy. Everybody thought you were some kind of person. But actually, it turns out you're something else. You feel naked, as if some of your identity has been ripped away from you, and you can no longer identify with those things. And that, of course, is painful when that happens. Yeah, so the things in the world are always, and this is kind of the point here, all the things in our life, they are like borrowed goods. Yeah, it feels like we own stuff. This is mine. Don't touch it. Yeah, this is my stuff. I control these things. But the point is, you don't control these things. Control is an illusion. We don't control because everything in nature is impermanent. It's always going to be taken from you sooner or later. Everything in life is borrowed goods. So whenever you feel that you own something, think again. Yeah, is it really mine? Do I really own this? Or is there some other truth that is more deep and profound in this case? And very often, things that we own that disappear already while we are alive. Relationships often break up. Things get lost or stolen. Yeah, our favorite little thing gets stolen or disappears. Always these things happen during life, but at the very latest, things have to go when you die. That is absolutely certain. In this sense, everything is borrowed goods. Everything has to be given back. Given back to what? Given back to nature. Nature owns these things, and nature always eventually claims back its own. And this is what you are seeing here. So remember that. Remember that things are like borrowed goods. It's like, you are, when things are like borrowed goods, it makes you change how you look at those things. It makes you kind of reevaluate what is going on. And of course, there are certain things in life that are less borrowed than others. When you are on your deathbed, there's a large number of things that you're going to have to give up, like we were talking about the other day. But there are a few things that you can take with you into the future. What are the things that you take with you? And what you take with you is the mind and the heart that you have developed for yourself in this life. If you have developed a beautiful heart of kindness, compassion, understanding, generosity, of wisdom, yeah, that is what you take with you. The lightness of the mind, the brightness of the mind, these qualities, they do not belong to this world. They belong to the mind. They are qualities of the mind that you have developed. And because that mind is what goes with us from one life to the next one, you take those qualities with you. So it makes you change the way you spend your time, how you invest your life. Yeah, you invest your life with a different kind of meaning. Why are you going to invest your life into all those things you're going to have to give back anyway? And it seems, maybe it looks to you like your life, yeah, my life is quite long, but life is really so short. Before you know it, you're going to die. Before you know it, it's all over. It's all going to have to be given back again. But this other thing, which where you develop your mind, it can go on for long, long periods of time. If you invest good qualities into your mind right here and now in this life, it can go on from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime, a long, long, long time into the future. So you change your investment strategy. You look at things in a different way. The way we spend our time, the way we imbue our life with meaning becomes different. How do we do this in practice? And it doesn't mean that we have to change our life dramatically in a kind of external way. You can still pretty much have the same old relationships. You can pretty much have the same old job, yeah, assuming that you have an ordinary job. You can still do this pretty much the same old things, but the way you do them is different. You look at that thing in a different way. Instead of being kind of goal-oriented, trying to achieve this, trying to achieve that, yeah, instead you become process-oriented. How do I achieve things? Do I achieve things with the right attitude, through kindness, through understanding, through compassion, through generosity, through wisdom? Yeah? If I achieve things in that way, if the process is what matters, then you are doing things in the right way. Become process-oriented rather than goal-oriented. If you are goal-oriented, if the goal is what matters, yeah, I want to achieve this, I want to become wealthy, I want to have this boyfriend or girlfriend, I want to have that advancement in my career. If you are goal-oriented, if that is what matters, first of all, you may not be able to achieve those goals. You never know whether the goals in life are actually achievable or not. And that is when you weep, beating your breast, yeah, because you cannot achieve your goals. One aspect of the first noble truth that we have a look at the very beginning here. Yeah, so very often you can't achieve them. But the other thing is that if the goal is what matters, then you get into this mindset where the goal justifies the means. Yeah, because the goal is important, the goal justifies the means. So in other words, how you get to that goal starts to become irrelevant. You start to cut corners. You start to break the five precepts. You start to live immorally. Why? Because the goal is important. And the process, actually, whatever process gets you to the goal, is satisfactory. The goal justifying the means is not a Buddhist idea. This is kind of a utilitarian idea, which is kind of very dangerous when you look at morality sometimes. So it is not like that in Buddhism. It is the process that matters. And if you live the process in the right way, if you do the process in the right way, actually, it doesn't matter so much if you achieve the goal or not. Okay, you still, that goal is kind of still at the back of your mind. But if you don't get there, well, you have lived the process well, you have done the right things, so you can still feel good about yourself, even if you didn't achieve the goal. The other person who achieves the goal, but did it in dodgy ways, even if they achieve the goal, they will feel bad about themselves afterwards. There was a little story that I was told by a person a few months ago, and he told me that he had this friend, who was very wealthy. He was still quite young, he wasn't very old at all, and become very wealthy early on in life. Yeah, but he said that to get to that point of being so wealthy, he had to do so many bad things. He had to cheat so many people, do so much, too much dodgy stuff. So one day when he got drunk, and he told this other person that I know, he told them that, you know, I feel so bad about myself. I feel so terrible. Yes, I'm kind of set up for life because I have all the money I need. But in the process, I did so many bad things that actually I feel terrible about myself. And this is where you achieve the goal, but you use a process that is unsuitable, and you destroy yourself in the process, and you feel terrible accordingly. And that's crazy, because then when you die, all the things that you achieved, all the money, all the status, all that has to go, and all you're left with is the remorse, the feeling terrible about yourself, and you can imagine where that leads you in the future. Yeah, so think big picture. Think what really matters. And if you do that, you are both happy in this life, and also you bring that happiness with you into the future. Don't invest in all this ephemeral things of the world that before you know it, they are gone. Don't invest in that. Invest in the process. Do things in the right way. There's nothing wrong with being successful. It's wonderful to be successful in life in whatever area. Nothing wrong with that. But make sure that you do it in the right way. Otherwise, the success is hollow. It's empty. It's meaningless. And then you have really destroyed your own life and destroyed everything, many other people's life, perhaps too, in the process. Think big picture, yeah? Think really long-term investment. That is what this is about. Okay. We can now come to the very last of the similes. Householder, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, and so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand, his foot, or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this man, who enters the jungle of trees, all kind of things. And you can imagine here that this jungle or the forest grove is like the sensual realm, Maybe you get reborn from some other realm and you get reborn in the sensual realm. So you're like in this forest, and you're wandering around in this forest. You see all kind of things, looking for the pleasures in the sensual realm, trying to find something nice for yourself. And then one day you come to this tree, mango tree, Everybody likes mango. Most people like, I mean, I'm sure there's someone who doesn't like mangoes. Most people like mangoes. You think, wow, look at those mangoes, they're all ripe. And you climb the tree. And then when you climb the tree and you get to those mangoes, you kind of indulge, because they're just perfectly ripe. You know what a perfectly ripe mango is nice? It's like, it's really, at least I love those perfectly ripe mangoes, and most people do. So you kind of really indulge in those wonderful mangoes. And while you indulge, you become a bit intoxicated. Sensual pleasures are intoxicating. This is one of the problems with them. They draw you in, you get intoxicated. And because you are intoxicated, you forget about the realities of life. You forget about that you're going to die. You forget that you, down the track, you're going to have to reap the consequences of your actions. And because of that, you end up doing many silly things because you are intoxicated. Just like being drunk on alcohol, you do bad things. You're drunk on sensual pleasures in exactly the same way. You end up doing bad things because these are what matter. The goal justifies the means. And then while you're in the middle of doing this, this other man comes along, and thinks, oh yeah, it would be nice to get some of those mangoes. So he chops down the tree. But because you are so intoxicated on top of the tree, you're completely heedless as to the dangers of reality. And because you are completely heedless, unless you regain your mindfulness in time, you will incur so much suffering because of that, so many problems because of your intoxication and your heedlessness on top of the tree. Yeah, so it is also intoxicating, the sensual pleasures. It distorts your outlook. It makes you see things in the wrong way. You get a vested interest in those sensual pleasures, and you cannot see clearly anymore. You don't know what is right and what is wrong. You can no longer choose the right thing, and you end up justifying being immoral, justifying to yourself doing all the bad stuff, because you have lost the clarity of your mind. So when you are intoxicated by sensual pleasures, when you are angry, when you are the defilements are overrunning your mind, it is always a bad time to make choices. Make choices when your mind is clear, when you feel at ease, relaxed, there's no big defilements going on that are leading you in the wrong direction, because they are vested interests. They're going to distort your outlook, and you're never going to be able to make wise choices as long as those attachments, long as those sensual pleasures are at the forefront of your mind, or even slightly at the back of your mind. So this is, I think, the message of this last one, yeah? And of course, the difference here again is the one day you come to that mountain, yeah? Like we saw that simile before, the two friends walking through the forest, and then you walk to the top of the mountain, and for the first time in your life, you get the overview, your oversight, you see things with a bird's eye view, and you understand what sensual pleasures actually are. You understand the problem. You understand the distortion outlook that comes from sensual pleasures. How you can never make a breakthrough. How you can never see things in accordance with reality as long as you are immersed in the sensual pleasures. You need to extricate yourself, first of all. Extract yourself from the mire, from the bog, from the mud. When you're out of the mud, then you have some ability to see what is actually going on. Get the bird's eye view. Go to the top of the mountain, climb that pyramid in the jungle, and then you know what is going on. Only then can you really understand the problem of these things. So, there you are. That is the last simile on sensual pleasures. And remember again, just to be clear about this, that the purpose of these things is just to keep you thinking, give you something to reflect on, yeah? Reflect on these things to see if they make sense or not. And then as you reflect on these things, they will have a little bit of impact on your life. Yeah, these things are, to me, just perfectly sensible. Of course, there is a degree of brainwashing going on. Yeah, of course, that's obviously the case, but it's good brainwashing. When you reflect on these things, it drives you towards truth, drives you towards reality. Yeah, and this is the beautiful thing about this. So give it time. Make these truths your own. See how they apply in your life. And then they start to become very powerful. And they start to drive you in the right direction. And it makes the spiritual path so much more efficient, so much faster, so much more happy if you follow along with these guidelines. Okay, that is all for now. We'll see you back again at 7:30 tonight.